right, welcome everybody to this next conversation with educational thought leaders. Today I'm with one of the foremost thought leaders in the area of educational technology. I'm talking with Stephen Downes. It's evening for Stephen. He's in Moncton in Canada, and it's a cold, chilly morning here. But Stephen is the Senior Research Officer for the National Research Council of Canada. He's also the editor of an online newsletter, which many of you will know about, that goes around the world every day and keeps us all up to speed on what is going on in the world of education and technology. Stephen, thanks a lot for making your time available. Really nice to be with you.
It's my pleasure.
All right, let's get going on that wide open first question. I think you're probably thinking about everything, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What are you currently pondering or reflecting on in relation to education?
Well, there's a few things. Obviously, I'm still interested in MOOCs and advances in MOOC technology. I don't think that we've seen the last word there yet. I don't think Stanford and MIT have defined it so that none of us can improve on it. I have a few things I'd like to add. I'd like to see what might be called a serialized course so that the MOOC can always be available. I'd also like to see what might be called a multi-level MOOC, which is to say, instead of focusing on one particular demographic, like, say, year one students, it would actually focus on a broader range of ability levels to create some sort of mixing between those levels. I'm interested in personal learning environments still. Haven't forgotten about that.
Yep.
I'd like to see that technology developed more fully. I see a PLE as an individualized way of accessing many online sources of learning, including MOOCs. And I'm interested in what might be called critical literacies. And, you know, this is more of a philosophical interest of mine. I'm interested in how we use digital artifacts as words or other means of communication in order to speak with each other. So those are the main things that are occupying my thoughts at the moment.
Well, that's prompted several questions from me. Could you say a little more about what's a serialized course?
This evolves out of a conversation I had with Tony Hurst 2 or 3 years ago. And the idea here is, in the first instance, the idea is you set up the course all ahead of time and then it just plays, right? So, for example, you could set up your course as an RSS feed and then somebody signs up for the RSS feed and it just plays. Well, that kind of makes sense. Mm. But different people would sign up at different times, right? Yeah. So what then? Well, you don't want to start in week 3. So whenever you sign up for the RSS feed, it starts you off at week 1. And your cohort is whoever signed up for that course that week with you. All of that can be done, I think, reasonably automatically. And if, you know, I suppose it's easier doing it the XMOOC way, but it's a lot more interesting if you're doing it the CMOOC way. So you don't know exactly what the resources are going to be or the discussions are going to be or even the topic will be any given week or any given instance of the course.
So this, love the idea, is not in, you don't have this running yet?
No, not yet. I had it in Grasshopper once. I had a serialized course all set up, and it worked reasonably well. I was the only one who ever signed up for them. This was back in the early days of MOOC, so I guess I had it running 2008 or 2009, somewhere in around there. I forget. You can look it up. I did a post in OL Daily on it. But I'm going to do it again. And it'll be more interesting this time because there's more interest in MOOCs. And I'll actually set it up as a MOOC, not just as a course, which is what I did last time. And I'll probably have it as a MOOC on critical literacies. So I'll tie all those things together. I think that should be interesting.
I can imagine people involved with assessment and reporting on assessment just pulling their hair out at an idea of a MOOC-C style where the content is
– yeah.
kind of surprising week by week.
Yeah. Yeah, it does make testing a bit more difficult, to be sure. But, my interest in testing is pretty minimal, so it doesn't really bother me.
We might come back to that. We'll see how the time goes. Hey, aren't MOOCs already multi-level? When you say multi-level MOOC?
Yeah, well, they are and they aren't. The MOOCs that George and I taught certainly were, especially like we taught CCK08 one year, and then CCK08, well, it was 09, the following year, and the people from the first year came back the second year. And so that MOOC had two levels in it right away, right? The people who were doing it for the first time, people were back for the second time. But you can take this concept more generally. And if you think of a subject like, say, logic, you can think of different tracks through the same content. So one track might be, you're looking at logic very informally. Another track might be you're looking at a more formal approach. Another track might be, you're interested in proving the validity of the more formal approach, etc. That's not exactly how I'd want to do it, but that gives you kind of an idea of the concept.
Someone in one of these conversations actually thought what we need to do is have a MOOC on how to run a MOOC, how to learn in a MOOC.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. It's interesting because Rita Kopp and I did Critical Literacies a few years back, I think it was 2010, and the concept of that course was, can people use a MOOC to learn how to learn in a MOOC? But of course, focused it on critical literacies rather than how to learn in a MOOC. So the emphasis was a bit different. But this would basically be it, right? Because, people say, and they always say, you need certain skills in order to be able to learn in a MOOC. Well, what are those skills? Those skills are the critical literacies in my mind.
I was going to ask you, and I guess you've already suggested what the answer will be, but when you talk about critical literacies, do you see that as a subset of digital literacies?
No, other way around. There's a whole bunch of literacies, right? There's plain old-fashioned literacy, which we might call language literacy or text literacy. Then there's mathematical literacy, which is numeracy. There's sometimes people talk about emotional literacy, which I think is a bit of a stretch, but it's there. There's digital literacy, etc. So think of each of these as a vertical, right? So horizontally or tangentially, horizontally more accurately, to each of those is a set of what I call the critical literacies. So each one of the literacies, like traditional literacy or digital literacy, would be characterized by this set of underlying critical literacies.
And what are they?
In a nutshell, pattern recognition or principle recognition, such as syntax, meaning, truth, and value, or which comes under the heading of semantics, action or use, which comes under the heading of pragmatics, context, contextual awareness, and localization, cognition, which breaks down into four major categories: description, definition, inference, and explanation, and then finally an understanding of change.
Are these new? Are these a result of educational technology or the use of, or have these things always been there and people have always thought of them as critical literacies in a pre-digital era?
They haven't characterized them exactly as I've characterized them here, but they all have, a deep tradition. Syntax, for example, that goes back to Plato and Aristotle and the forms and the syllogisms, right? There's a long history, with meaning, truth, and value, semantics, we think about Tarski, for example, or Kripke. Change, change has roots in Chinese philosophy, I Ching, the Books of Change. And it also has roots in German philosophy with Hegel and the syllogism. Not the syllogism, the, Oh, I've forgotten what Hegel system is called.
That's all right. I won't be able to help you.
the dialectic, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Yeah, so all of these have deep, deep roots in, you know, in the study of cognition and reasoning. They all form, you know, they all play a critical role in traditional literacies. You know, you look at traditional literacy, we think of things like grammar, we think of Chomsky and deep grammar and syntax. Mm-hmm. That's all, you know, syntax, pattern recognition, similarity recognition, that sort of thing.
I'm just thinking of the average teacher, lecturer, and if you presented this list to them as things that they need to be aware of, they'd be fairly confused, I'd imagine.
Well, it's a bit daunting when you just lay it all out like that, right? You know, but if you think of this as, you know, this is the sort of thing that we'll look at over the course of 12 weeks, and it's not a bunch of stuff to memorize, it's just a bunch of stuff to practice with. And if you pick up some sort of formal awareness of it, great. But if you just practice in it, also great. Then it's a different sort of thing. You know, I mean, like, take pattern recognition, which is the first one, right? Mm-hmm. The best way to become good at pattern recognition is to practice pattern recognition. Now, Sesame Street had it done. You know, which of these things belong together? Which of these things is not the same? That's pattern recognition, right? And mm-hmm. it's just, you know, so you can just do stuff in pattern recognition. And, you know, first time through the course, just play around with it. Second time through the course, maybe try to be a bit creative with it. You know what I mean? So it doesn't need to be this deep, formal object of study. You know, the critical literacies, properly so called, form the premises of the design of the course, but it doesn't mean people have to memorize them. That would be absurd.
Okay. If we can swing back to digital literacy and what you said about personal PLNs or PLEs, personal learning networks or environments, is that a digital literacy?
Well, it's part of it. I mean, you don't want to take any moment in the history of technology, such as the current moment, and say, well, this is technological literacy, because, you know, tomorrow it'll all be changed. So what is digital literacy? You know, it's understanding how to comprehend, work with, and communicate with these digital technologies. And it's going to have these different aspects. Now, think about, for example, not how you run a computer program like Word, but how do you learn a computer program in general? Well, you know, there's the old thing, right? You know, people who are digitally literate don't read the instructions. They just start messing around with the program. They do an exploration of what all the commands do. They try things out. So there's your element of pattern recognition right off the bat. You know, digital literacy involves understanding what a program can be used for, understanding the value of a program, what constitutes good output from the program, what constitutes bad output from the program, and that's this aspect of semantics, and so on. I could run through the six, but I won't. But you get the idea that, you know, it's not about learning specific technologies or a certain set of ethics having to do with technology. I know that, you know, if we look at digital literacy as it's defined in various places, you know, and it covers things like, you know, can you use the technology? Can you communicate with it? Can you create with it? Mm-hmm. You know, do you follow copyright properly and all of that? And to me, that's not digital literacy. That's, you know, memorizing a bunch of stuff and calling yourself literate as a consequence. It's like knowing the alphabet, but it's not, you know, making sentences and words. You know, digital literacy is about treating these technologies as a language and being able to access and immerse yourself in these technologies in a fruitful and constructive way, whatever these technologies might happen to be. Because again, tomorrow, next year, they're going to be completely different. You know, it's like before this interview, me messing around with my microphone volume in Skype. Being able to do that and make it work or not, you know, or live with it not working, that's digital literacy.
Is there an implied positive ethic in any of this, or is it totally neutral?
People choose their own ethics. I mean, you know, literacy doesn't come with ethics attached. You know, there's a whole history of ethics, and, you know, I have my own views on ethics, which would take us a bit to a digression. But I mean, people have the choice. They can take a utilitarian approach where the proper use of a technology is one that maximizes the good, not just for oneself, but for society as a whole. You can take the Kantian approach based in a categorical imperative, where, you know, the people who use technology should be thought of as ends and not means, and each person is of value in themselves, and you should create philosophical maxims or ethical maxims based on the principle, what if everyone did this? Or you could take, you know, just common sense ethics, a folk ethic, if you will. You can take a Rawlsian approach and think of our work in the digital environment as forming kind of a social contract with each other, and we need to, by engaging in the internet, we've agreed implicitly to adhere and abide by that social contract. All of those are very different approaches, right? And depending on which, and there are other approaches, depending on which approach you take, you're going to get a different answer to some common questions like, you know, what is plagiarism? What is copyright? What is, et cetera. These ethics questions always seem to come down to respecting copyright, which seems to me to be a very narrow purpose, but that's just me.
Back to the PLN, or not the continuation of the question. Do you think the having a personal learning network or environment is going to be more important for success of a person in society, success defined in terms of, you know, successful job and study, I suppose?
Well, it comes back to ethics, what success and all of that. Let me first characterize or draw a distinction. A personal learning environment is a tool or set of tools you use to communicate with people and systems around you. A personal learning network is that set of people that you work with in order to learn. So there's a bit of a difference between a PLE and a PLN. A PLE is technology, a PLN is a bunch of people.
Okay.
Social contacts have always been important for success, however you define success. Whether it's a happy life or making a pile of money, either way, social connections seem to be important. So I think that your personal learning network is going to be important. The technology you use is ethically neutral in the sense that you can use it productively or you can abuse it. People who spam abuse the technology. People who use Twitter to promote good feelings and help people are using the technology well. And I think in the end, your success is going to be based on how well and how generously and magnanimously you use the technology rather than simply forming the networks themselves.
Mm-hmm. I want to step right outside of technology at the moment and ask you that question. Amongst the ones that I sent you was, what, if anything, should be retained from more traditional modes of delivery? So teaching as it looked like before we had internet and connected technology.
Well, that's a good question. I think literacy is still good. I think we should still be teaching people to read. It's literacy is the great liberator. That's why I think the critical literacies are so interesting because they're even more of a liberator. I think, you know, we used to have an idea of learning as being much more based in practice than we do now. The way we learn now with teachers in classrooms is a relatively recent invention. It's not that old. And prior to that, learning was based on either an apprenticeship in some sort of trade or, you know, the family farm or business or whatever, or it was some sort of tutorship or mentorship. That's what the rich people got. And in all of those cases, the intent of the learning was to put the students into what we today call authentic situations and working with whatever the topic area is, and working with other people to progress in that area. And I think that's always been a valuable approach to learning. I think that as the technology makes it possible, we'll return to that. You know, recently we employed a technology called the classroom and the teacher in order to speed up the learning process. And we did that because that was the only way to do it. But now I think we'll have more choices.
So that we might, for example, choose to, I could sign up with you to be an apprentice with you to study logic or something to do with philosophy.
Yeah, or probably something a little less formal. I mean, something like what we're doing now might become much more typical of education in the future. And if you think about it, you know, I can't do this with 1,000 or 1,000,000 people, but I can do it with some, and then they can do it with others. And you get this network effect of, you know, bilateral communications spreading through the society. And we can do that now. And I think that's feasible and practical.
So what we're talking about retaining is a social element that was always part of traditional teaching, the kind of mentor-mentee approach.
Well, I think we're going to retain the social element because we're humans and we live in a society. You know, it's not something inherent to the human brain that it must learn socially or anything like that. It has much more to do with the environment in which we find ourselves. You know, we could learn on a desert island. We'd learn different stuff. We probably wouldn't learn language, but we'd certainly learn the tides. But, you know, we don't live on a desert island. We live in cities, towns, and villages, and so we need to learn about each other and with each other because that's where we live.
How do you feel about the current state of e-learning design? Do you see trends that inspire or worry you?
I think they're learning. I mean, 10 years ago we had learning objects and learning design, properly so called, where everything was scripted and, you know, e-learning was basically the electronic equivalent of a military training manual. Mm-hmm. I think we've come a long way from that. You know, there's still learning design, but we're beginning to go beyond that. We have things like learning technologies, interoperability, which enables e-learning platforms to launch a wide variety of applications. We're seeing a slow but steady, inexorable rise of simulation and similar sort of technology. We're seeing the beginning development of what used to be called heads-up display, and today we call them Google Glass, but the idea of being able to project information into an environment. You know, these sorts of things are all, you know, small steps in the progression of learning. And we're seeing, you know, social learning. We went through that phase with e-learning 2.0, you know, and that stuck. Even the MOOCs, I mean, what the MOOCs represent most of all is a much wider social acceptance of free and open learning. I think that's a huge, significant step forward. So generally I feel pretty positive about it. It doesn't mean everything is all gravy, we've progressed a lot in the last 10 years.
So I'm actually pleased to hear
you talk about MOOCs as something which I think has been, in essence, a good thing, if I was to sum up good or bad. The question that I sent you implies that it has had a transformative effect in higher ed. Others have questioned that. So what about MOOCs and higher ed and their potential in the Australian bet sector? And you've been down here a few times. Yeah. You might remember what it's like. So where are they going? What's their place from here on?
It's been a little while since I've been in Australia, actually. It's been a few years now. Kind of miss the place. I miss the nice warm winters. I mean, people talked about MOOCs as transformative, and of course they refer to this whole theory of transformative technology, which I think is a bit overblown. They certainly have an impact. They're changing what we call the value proposition of education in general, because what educational institutions used to be able to offer or thought they offered now can be obtained essentially for free on the internet. And so they're forcing these institutions to rethink what it is that they do. And we're seeing a variety of different responses. I think the response that probably most characterizes what the value that universities actually offer, but they won't tell anyone, is the response that focuses on the social network or connections that attendance at a given university can give you. In other words, it's not just about the education. The whole concept of the university is to set yourself up for life with, you know, the good foundations, the social skills, but also, you know, the connections, the relationships, and all of these other intangibles that aren't part of the curriculum. These are really valuable things. They're hugely valuable. I can't underestimate them. And I think the real challenge is going to be when people learn to develop these social networks and these not simply social networks, but networks of power, relationships, and commerce outside the traditional setting. And when that happens, that's the last part of the university's value proposition that falls. And then they really need to be thinking about how they go about what they're doing. I think that there's a necessity for a public institution that provides that kind of infrastructure. But I think there needs to be a much deeper understanding on both the part of the providers and the part of the funders as to what that infrastructure needs to be. So I think there's going to be a conversation that starts happening now that tries to get to the bottom of what is it exactly that our educational system provides to our population. And you know, this goes all the way from, you know, the kindergarten level. I don't know if you have kindergarten in Australia. You must.
Yeah, we do.
From kindergarten all the way through to graduate school, what is it that our system delivers? I think what we know, certainly looking at the U.S. example, is it's not just a bunch of facts and knowledge that you can test, because we see them emphasizing that more and more, and we see them falling further and further behind. So we know it's not that. The content's important, but the content's important kind of like you need a story to read a book, but the story and the reading of the book is just part of the story. There's a whole lot more that goes along with it, and it's understanding what that is. The whole, you know, from socialization to development of social networks to, you know, this all these intangibles that, you know, you can't even name, that are provided as part of an education. And they've sort of been gradually added to the traditional system more or less well. And they're going to need to be transferred over to the much more accessible, much more democratic digital system.
Well, you mentioned testing earlier as something that you are particularly interested in, or that's maybe not what you said, but it doesn't bother you. And when you talk about these kinds of things being perhaps the more important outcomes of an education, the nightmare is, how do you assess these things?
Well, actually, that's the one thing that gets easier with technology. And testing has always been a crude and blunt instrument, right? And this is part of the fallacy of the whole content movement. When you test for content knowledge of any sort, or even when you test for a skill, what you've done is you've taken knowledge of that domain and you've abstracted it in a certain way. And then you're looking for signs of that abstraction. And the problem is when you do that, all effort focuses on the abstracted version of the thing rather than the knowledge of the thing itself. So testing becomes a very imperfect form of measurement. There's plenty of evidence for this. We know that the people who score highest on the high school tests aren't necessarily the ones who do the best at the university. We know people who score the highest in a university class aren't necessarily the ones who do best in society. I mean, George W. Bush was a C student and became president. Now, we could argue if he was a bad president, sure, but he became president.
But he got there.
But he got there. So, you know, there's something that the C score that he was given missed, something that his fraternity membership captured. But now, in the digital era, more and more and more of our lives go online. And some of it we want to go online, some of it we don't. There's a big issue there about allowing and not allowing certain elements online. And that's another conversation we have to have in society. But the point is, much more of our lives are online now. Much more of our lives are accessible, can be, if you will, machine read and digitally analyzed. If you took the right kind of computer program, a reasonably smart computer program, I would hope, and turned it loose on my online profile, on my online footprint.
Yeah.
So it would look at all my discussion posts, all my tweets, all my photos, all my blog posts, anything I did. It should be able to give you a pretty good sense of whether or not I'm an expert in anything. Human beings do that now. It's exactly what human beings do. Why did you pick me, for example, to interview? It's not because I passed a test, at least none that I'm aware of. It's because you looked at the various assemblage of my stuff online and said, well, maybe he knows something about this. You made a judgment call. You made an inference based on a process of recognition. And recognition is how assessment will happen in the future. It's a very human process. One person, preferably somebody who's already an expert, recognizes or sees in the sum total of a person's performance whether or not they are an expert. Software can do this too. It's, you know, you think of the way we recognize a face, it's the same kind of process. We can recognize a skill. And once we have that, and we're not very far from having that now, the whole question of whether we have tests becomes kind of moot. We have a system that you can't really fool the way you could fool the test. If you really are putting this whole profile out in your totality of online activities, then you actually are skilled and competent in that area. And it's the sort of thing you can't mess up. You can't fool the system because the system captures everything.
And I guess that's maybe what a modern teacher should be doing, is facilitating the evolution of that kind of digital presence for people who are in their care.
There's a good analogy here to be drawn from the world of sports. I was going to use baseball, but you don't do baseball in Australia. But you do
not
do
that
cricket
down here. We do cricket, yes.
You do cricket, right? Yep. And there are statistics in cricket, right?
Thousands of them.
Yeah. So, and the thing is, when you teach a person to play cricket, you don't teach them to attempt to achieve some kind of statistic. You attempt to have them learn the whole game. You don't want somebody to always be shooting for sixes You want them to develop a broad-based hitting approach where, you know, you can maximize your potential scoring on every given pitch or ball or whatever it's called.
Pitch, yeah, ball. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, if you're swinging for a six every time, you're going to go out. You're going to get, you know, I forget what it's called, but
you'll get out.
You'll get out. So you can't bat for the statistic. You have to bat for the game, the situation, the field, the defenders, etc. And that's an overall skill. And that's the sort of thing that coaches and even spectators recognize in a player. It's reflected in statistics, but statistics don't define that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And everything you do on a cricket field is these days videotaped, recorded, measured, calculated, and you can run computer programs that rank the effectiveness of various cricket players. Or in North America, we have Nate Silver, who does polling statistics. He analyzes baseball players and also presidential elections.
I'm going to finish off with a little anecdote connected with what you've just been saying. And I watched a game of Australian football a couple of years ago. I then went to the airport to wait my flight home, and I was in the same lounge as the football team, and several players of the team that I'd seen just 2 hours before running around on a football field were sitting at a bench in the lounge with a laptop with a personalized view of the game of their performance.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And that was within 2 hours of the game being over. I just thought, wow. Yeah.
And it's unbelievable how effective something like that is. I mean, getting that instant feedback, and you can see what you did, and you still remember having done it, and now you're seeing the video, and you're realizing, oh, that was good, that was bad, that got us scored on.
Yeah. We've been over our time, Stephen. I've thoroughly enjoyed talking with you. We could probably have a lot of conversations, and maybe we will in the next several months, that might spin off from any of the topics you've raised. But thank you very, very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
All the best, Stephen. Thanks.
And enjoy your Australian winter.
It's short, and it's another month and it's gone, but thanks. Cheers.
Cheers.